Views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
You sure about that? There was a moment of hesitation.
Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Bill.
Hey, our sponsor this hour is
Pathé
Machinery.
I don't talk to him in the car just so we can do all this when we get here.
You just cut off my sponsor.
I know.
Yeah.
I kind of like it. Throws you for a loop.
Okay. Okay, so our sponsor this hour is Pathé Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. And they're going to fix you up with tractors, implements, mowers, you name it, they got it. They're also a Honda dealer, so if you're in the dark right now listening to us on a battery radio, swing by tomorrow and pick up a generator. They got lots in stock, every shape and size. You can give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Ta-da.
There you go.
And you can find everything about the show, including all the commercial-free archives that are no cost to listen to, no cost to download. You can, I don't know, you could burn them on CDs and sell them. You could add them to your own website.
I want a cut of that.
We don't really care. Bill has no idea what goes on online, so just go ahead and do whatever you want. But those are on there all the way back to 2010, and you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. You also have video. If you click on the Archives tab, there are videos for almost every show, I think, this year in 2020. So today is October 25th, 2020, just to give it some context in case we replay it, because I'm sure we will. So we're talking about forest fires, and there are forest fires everywhere, but for the moment we're going to talk about West Coast forest fires. I don't know, specifically California? Or just West Coast?
West Coast,
okay. So I wasn't sure about that one. I put California forest fires. I might have to change that. But there's a lot of talk about how this is all being caused by climate change and, sky spraying and, all these different things that are causing all these forest fires. And, it's funny when you talk to people who have a background in forestry, like our friend Ray Halp, who's here today, how many years?
33 years.
33 years.
Over 40 as a forester.
Yeah. So when you talk to an actual forester who's been around for four decades, well, you've been around longer than that, but you and Bill are up there in the, in the rarefied
air. Child during the Great War.
Drugs again.
I do remember the 60s, actually.
I was a little kid. I lived right near Woodstock, but I didn't know what happened until I was in college. I saw it in a documentary and kind of did the geography. I was like, wait a second, I live near that. My parents did a good job. We had no clue. But so we're going to talk about how forestry affects all these things. And I would say,
or the lack
is the cause.
Good forestry.
Lack of good forestry. And we have tons of public land out here. We'll get into all that stuff because it's not federal land. It's public land. So, wash your mouth out with soap if you're saying federal land, because that's bad. It doesn't belong to the federal government. It belongs to you. So back in, you started federal service back in 1976.
Yes, ma'am. Back in the dark ages.
I was in high school. I was actually in high school, though. It was pretty good. We lived in Connecticut. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
Bicentennial. All right. So where would you like to start today? And just in case you think Ray's talking out of his hat, you can go read his bio. It's very long. It's very very detailed. And he has excellent credentials, we might say. And he's a county supervisor as well. So he kind of put his old skill set to work. How's that? To try to help Siskiyou County. And actually, it's working on a lot of fronts. But, the Forest Service is kind of like pushing a rope. So that's not your fault.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Probably why I left.
We'll absolve you from that right now. Forest Service is a problem of its own.
Yeah. No. Thanks for the introduction. I can't quit. as far as being a forester. It is my life. You know, it's professionally, it's my passion. And I see a lens through a lens most of the time of natural resource management, which is my profession as well. And, you know, after retirement, I decided, you know, to put those skills to work and educating some folks. And I taught college for 4 years.
How was that anyway?
That was wonderful. You know, it was really wonderful. You know, to grab a hold of folks and, you know, at any age, actually, because it was a community college piece, and watch them learn about things they really had no understanding of was pretty rewarding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of my students have gone on now into professional jobs. And
doing useful things with actual information?
Yeah, they are. Some are working in private industry as foresters. Some are wildlife biologists. Some got dual degrees in wildlife and forestry at Humboldt State. And it's really nice to see that.
That's true. We should bring that up. You and I both graduated from Humboldt State.
Well, I didn't.
You didn't graduate out of
it? I went back.
You just went?
No, I went back to school there in forest engineering.
I graduated from it. But we both went.
I'm a Cal Poly grad.
And Doug, yeah.
Yeah.
But the good part is we both went to Humboldt State and we didn't turn out to be weirdos. which some may dispute.
I'll pass on that.
Okay.
Travis is in there waving his arms like he's landing a plane. Yeah, okay, we saw you in there.
So I don't know. You know, I've always been intrigued with a lot of different things that faced our county, natural resource issues with water and forestry. And I saw the county struggling, basically, because technical expertise wasn't there to navigate through all these issues, and I certainly had a plethora of it, retiring as a district ranger for the Forest Service locally. And, you know, I decided one day, you know, I think I'll run for supervisor and see if we can clean up a few things and move forward in today's world using some real facts and real science.
So it's kind of a lofty goal.
That's, well, you know.
Just when you think lofty goals are passe.
Well.
But actually, you've gotten a lot done. You've been there how long? Five years?
6 years. This will be my sixth year. Yep. Two more years to go, my second term.
I don't believe that's what most of the people think is going to happen. They think you're going to stay there forever. You're going to go Strom Thurmond on them.
Yeah. No.
Our supervisor's 105 years old.
No, and I have a real anomaly these days, I suppose. I mean, working for the government as long as I did, I'm a real small government, anti-government kind of guy, you know, because I've seen how inefficient it is. And used to drive me nuts when I was working for the government, but that's just
so
kind of the way it was designed.
You got out and you still heard, what's going on with the Forest Service? So
are you kidding me? Yeah.
Yeah.
All day, every day.
Yeah.
Yeah, because people want to know. It's like they think there's some, I don't know, master plan in the background. <It's> like,
you know, I was confronted with that all the time while I was
like, what are they doing? Are they
working?
Having like secret
meetings?
Yeah,
yeah,
right?
It's like, oh my gosh, they have a unified force and they're going to do something, you know, unified all across the nation at one point in time. I said, for a lot of that, you know, I said, you ought to work here. I can't get four people in the same office to figure out where they're going to lunch, you know?
yeah, like Trump would say at his rally, what the hell do you think's going on? Oh, my gosh. So we've got a couple minutes here before we have to take a break. But what – all right, so set us up.
Okay.
What about all the, you know, what about all the policy that people see now, you know, where we're not cutting the trees, we have trees everywhere, but we're burning up at, you know, a million acres of
a pop. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Just is it 4 million this year?
Pretty complicated question. I can't do it in 2 minutes.
No. But I mean, just like, yeah, that's kind of where,
yeah,
we're headed.
Yeah. And I would like to talk in our next segment a little bit more about those complexities and what's really driving the current issues we're seeing with these fires playing out on the landscape. Some of the things are similar and some are different.
Hmm.
You know, of course, big elephant in the room is temperature and climate and all those kinds of things and how that feeds into this. Or maybe it's not as different as it was in the past. So
Yeah, because
we can explore that.
Yeah, we'll hit that after the break. Because I remember when I moved to Reading in the 80s, I mean, in the summertime, 115, 117, that was pretty much standard. I mean, you just counted on that.
Yeah.
We have not had that high heat for several years. So, yeah, we'll
at least not the kind that goes for weeks and weeks and weeks on
right.
end.
Right, yeah, 2, 3, 4 weeks in a row of 110 plus, you know, we haven't had that.
The other thing, too?
Mm-hmm.
Is drought.
Sure. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, and maybe how we're causing our own drought.
Yeah, and I'll talk about how the fuels indices are now versus before, and forested conditions and those kinds of things that are leading to these mega disasters.
Yeah, it's funny when you can actually avoid these things and you don't. Who's not smart then?
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll take a really swift break, and we'll be right back with you. Our guest is Ray Haupt, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Join me weekday mornings from 6 to 7 with the Sue McClain News Hour. I'll have your up-to-the-minute local news, national and international news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Followed by Free Fire Radio from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to riding routes, pop culture, and unsung heroes of our area. From 7 to 9, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com.
KCNR 96.5 FM and KCNR 1460.com and AM 1460 are honoring our veterans this holiday season by offering Operation Holiday Salute 2020. During the months of November and December, we are offering a discounted advertising package including one live appearance during Free Fire Radio for businesses that support our veterans. And the best part is, a portion of that package price goes to support homeless veterans. Call KCNR today at 530-605-4565.
Reading Rancheria. We are proud to play our part in the community. This is Tracy Edwards, CEO of Reading Rancheria. Since the Community Fund was established, over $3.5 million in grants have been awarded to our local nonprofit organizations. We are dedicated to supporting worthy causes in our region and help make possible the impactful work done by our local nonprofits, and will continue to do so during these changing times. Reading Rancheria, proud to play our part.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them?
Indeed. So on the break, we were asking Ray, you know, how many people in the Forest Service are actually foresters, and he said not really very many. But then I was curious, how many like forest supervisors are foresters? Well, no requirement there.
No.
Yeah, go ahead and tell us what you told us after that, because I'm not sure if you say it with a straight
face. Yeah, tell us what a qualified forester.
No, I want to know about the foresters in the Forest Service.
Well, it depends where you are. You know, or what position you're in. If you are a silviculturalist, somebody like that.
What does that mean?
They're Well, there are certifications, if you will, internal certifications. So they're much higher qualified than someone who might have the title of forester. You know, if you have the title of forester, according to OPM regulation, it just requires a certain set of classes, but not necessarily a degree in forestry to be there. Now, as a private forester, as I am, and a practicing one, you not only have to do that, but you have to be under an apprenticeship for the first part of your lead up to taking an exam as a licensed forester. And once you get that, it's you're certified as a forester to operate in the state. But until you go through an apprenticeship and you go through the licensing process, you're not a legal forester in the eyes of the court in California.
And so what does what in private practice, what's a forester do?
A forester is basically a, you know, complete land manager for a tract of land, responsible for all the rules, regulation, implementation, harvest, and the growth and yield of the owner's land that they manage.
So they would be qualified in keeping the forest healthy, keeping it to where it's regenerating all the time, that sort of thing.
Well, if they didn't, they would be fired because that's the company's bottom line.
That's their bottom line, is they want to harvest trees.
Yeah, now, you know, you might work for somebody who doesn't look at growth and yield that much, but wants something else done with their property, like fuels treatments, and make, you know, make it look a little more park-like. Well, you could hire a forester to do that as well. I mean, the forester basically works at the behest of the landowner and what they want on their property within state law.
Right. And then in the forestry service, a forester would do what you said, make sure all the rules and regulations are being followed, and supposedly the land's being taken care of.
Good chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, they're out of business.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so the idea that, you know, Sierra Pacific or some company can buy, you know, large swaths of land, just run out there and willy-nilly cut down all the trees?
Yeah.
Yeah, the likelihood of that is
Not under zero. Today's forest practices rules in the state of California. Most states have adopted rules that prohibit that. They require reforestation, those kinds of things. There are some exemptions, like under our state, which I think should be tightened a little bit, is that, you know, if there's a fire and destroys your timberland, you can harvest it, but you really don't have to reforest it. That's pretty short-sighted, I think, because the act itself is to perpetuate forested cover.
And that's on private land?
That's on private land.
And when a fire goes through on public land, we run out and harvest that as well, don't we?
No.
No. And so that's a lot of money we throw away, public money.
We're burning our children's and grandchildren's future right now.
Yeah, because when you're, I don't know what the acreage is. Like, how what percentage is Siskiyou County of forest?
Public land in Siskiyou County is 62% of the land base.
Take the big bite out of
here. Yeah, so there's no tax revenue from that unless there is active management on that land.
Because when the Forest Service harvests timber on public land, they kind of give people a little bit of that. Like, why would they want to do that? Besides the fact it's healthier.
Well, for one thing, 25% of those receipts come back to the county for the support of roads and schools.
Schools, right.
And, you know, right now, with the Northwest Forest Plan that was replaced by PILT payments that started out. Like
payment in lieu of taxes.
Yes. It started out in our county at $8.5 million a year, which was the historic level of receipts. And it's down now to us scrapping for $2.5 to $3 million.
Yeah, because the schools, I think, suffered a lot from this whole forestry practice now, because they don't get any money like they used to. Some of these rural school districts were pretty fat because they benefited from proper forest management.
Well, they did, and the other you know piece of that's really missing anymore is the effect of. When you have people doing that work to generate that rather than giving a payment out, you have a business effect right. on the outside that's tremendous.
Sure, you got an actual economy percolating right. in
your families who are working yeah. and community. Being right. able to support themselves.
And supporting other businesses and those kinds of things that sure. that feed into that economy. But you don't have that with a payment.
No. The other thing, so when they do that, when they just supposedly, it's like every year is a big scramble for that. And you never know if the counties are going to get that or not.
Yeah.
So that payment isn't necessarily guaranteed. And my understanding is that at this point it's kind of viewed at the federal level as like rural welfare. I mean, it's gone from like a trade. Here we're going to put your land into public land. We're going to take it out of your county production. We're going to put it into public land so everyone can use it, and we'll pay you to do that. And now it's like, well, you rural people, I guess we'll toss you your payment in lieu of taxes, welfare payment this year.
Yeah. Well, but in reality.
Which is not what that is.
No.
But that's kind of the way it's treated.
That is the way it's treated. That's the way it's perceived because, you know, as time goes on, people forget where that came from. You know, that was a compromise in the Northwest Forest Plan that President Clinton signed as a guarantee to offset the reduction in timber harvest in rural counties. And
that really hasn't really panned out.
No, but, and, you know, just like everything else in government, you know, a few years go by and everybody forgets why they were doing something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that works.
Yeah.
Well, like my mother lives in an area up in Mineral, which is up by Mount Lassen, and there was a time they had a real vibrant community up there. They had a middle school that had, I don't know, 150 kids in it.
They had a lot of kids in that school.
A lot of kids in that school, and they did quite well. They had enough money to do all the programs and the sports and everything with the kids. It's gone. They don't have it anymore. Those kids get bused 40 miles to school every day now.
Yeah.
And the families have moved out of that area because there's really no community.
Well, and they killed the ski park, too.
The old ski park went away. That was another biggie, but... there's just no economy up there anymore. I mean, it's pretty much just some retired people that live up there, and the people with kids have moved out of the area, most of them. Not enough to run a school.
Because you can't make a living.
Yeah.
You know, the worst thing I hear all the time is the retort is always that you just want to return to the 80s. No, I don't.
No.
Because, you know, I am an intelligent.
A lot of bad things happened in the 80s.
Well, but even in my own profession, I'm an intelligent learning person. And there were things in the 80s that we shouldn't repeat, you know. And, you know, the 80s are the 80s, and they're gone. And my profession changes greatly. I mean, the mills that supported what happened in the 80s aren't there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at a completely different set of products and ways to machine smaller timber today than we ever even considered in the 80s. In the 80s, it was just trash, and it was burned.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not modern forestry anymore.
No. Well, plus they don't have the big trees like they used to have. It was it's all scaled down to a certain size, and
and
I think you hit it right on the head. There just isn't as many mills around anymore.
Well, you had 21 mills in Siskiyou County,
something like that. We had, you know, 7 in Happy Camp alone.
Really?
Yeah, during the 70s and 80s.
And that's now zero.
Zero.
But Happy Camp, any idea how much you burned up? How much timber burned up there yet? Any estimates?
I don't have an estimate yet. I can't imagine because the...
Because you had multiple fires, I guess, over...
Multiple fires, and all the acreage is high-severity fire, which means it's all dead.
When you have 7 mills running, that's a lot of jobs, and that's a lot of people that live in that community, and when you take that away, there goes the community.
And it also produced the higher receipts that we don't see today because there was competition in the market.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing you have, you know, you have a vibrant industry that works. But if you follow the logic that shuts all this down in the 70s, you had 7 mills running in Happy Camp in that area, and they were running. I'm assuming all the time, supported the community. So if in fact that destroys all of the trees and just strips the ground and there's nothing left. It's amazing that they've had so many fires.
Yeah.
Since then.
Yeah.
Because what's burning?
Yeah.
It's parallel.
Because apparently they cut it all down,
they
right?
They stripped the land.
Oh, wait. I guess they didn't cut it all down.
Yeah.
And we see that in Reading, too. Reading's economy has totally changed with the absence of the mills. I mean, we've got, what, two mills now in the local area? And there were mills all the way up and down from here to Red Bluff. I mean, we had mills, and they're all gone.
Yeah, I'd like you to talk about what's happening now with some of that timber being harvested out of that fire over there in Happy Camp and how hard it is to get it processed.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with it at this point? So, because I apparently am blind and I can't see Travis giving me the high sign or watch my clock, Bill just gave me the universal break sign, so I better do it. Better do it or I'll be in trouble.
Right. I'm in charge. we'll talk off air.
The keys are in my purse here down under the table if you need them. You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Got trapped by a girl, but a wiggle free. Heard the organ timber calling me. Will you tell me something, Mr. Lumberjack? Is it one for forward and three for back? Is it two for stop or four for go? Boy, ask a whistle punk, I don't know. Well, I learned this fact from a logger named Ray. You don't cut timber on a windy day. Stay out of the woods when the moisture's low. Or you ain't gonna live to collect your dough. Will you tell?
Dr. Farrell in Palisadro is now making dental work more affordable by offering a Dental Discount Savings Plan annual membership. The Dental Discount Savings Plan is simple, straightforward, and includes 20% off all treatment, such as emergency limited exams, restorative work, fillings, crowns, partials, bridges, dentures, and periodontal treatment, a comprehensive exam, oral cancer screening, a TMJ exam, a periodic exam, and two sets of x-rays, along with cleaning and two fluoride treatments. The program is a discount plan, not a dental insurance plan, and is only available at the office of Dr. Farrell. The Dental Discount Savings Plan annual membership provides immediate eligibility. No yearly maximum, no deductibles, no claims to submit, no limitations for pre-existing treatment, and no waiting periods. Children on the plan must be 15 years or younger. Some restrictions apply. Membership prices may vary. Contact Dr. Farrell, located at 9461 Deschutes Road, Suite 2 in Palisadro. Call 547-57 to make an appointment today. That's 547-5757.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
I expect it to be a lot easier.
I didn't know what step to take next.
I was transitioning from the military. I was a vehicle gunner.
An avionics specialist.
I missed my unit, my family.
Playing with my daughter, I'd felt like a stranger.
I didn't have a clear sense of what to do next.
And then I thought, if I'm going through this, other veterans have gone through it too, right?
So I reached out, and I saw that I wasn't alone.
Go to maketheconnection.net to learn how other veterans have overcome the challenges of transitioning out of the military.
When somebody's actually in the studio with us, because then we talk during the break.
Yeah.
I don't know
what we talk about.
Normally we can't do it.
On the air or off the air.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, let's just do what we just did. Okay, so in Happy Camp, just because that was a recent fire here that I think, you know, most people heard about. If you didn't, you should go look it up. Plus, it has a fun name of a place and easy to remember. Okay, so the Forest Service is actually pulling a lot of that burned timber out.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot.
Well, the county.
But
the
now where are you?
You basically have a forest highway there that goes from Highway 96 over to Cave Junction, Oregon. And the first part of it's county, county-maintained road. And, it is a highway. It's not, just two-trail road out through the woods. The county is working with haulers and logging companies to clear the right-of-way along the lower part of the road, and the Forest Service has 12 miles to do just on the California side, clearing the right-of-way of hazard trees.
But that's all they're cutting out is just the right-of-way trees. They're not going in and...
No, right now that's an emergency action that's taking place so we can get the road back open for the public and be able to use the road. But this isn't your typical road you might see wandering through, the backwoods or whatever. This is literally going through some of the most dense timber stands in our county, mostly Douglas fir, which grows pretty tight. And the volume per acre is just horrendous as far as the amount of work that needs to be done there.
So once they've taken those trees down, mm-hmm. we just talked about how all the mills are basically gone.
Yeah.
So what do they do with it? Is it now profitable? Can they convert that into something? Because I think people want those, the burned timber taken out. Any of it that's resaleable in a decent period of time so it doesn't just rot on the ground and all that.
Yeah.
But the difficulty is?
Well, there's a lot of difficulties. Number one, transportation costs. With the mill shut down in Cave Junction, the Rough and Ready mill that went down a few years ago would have been the primary place to take that. It's fairly close, but it's outside the working circle of most mills, which means their area of influence for profitability.
Mm-hmm.
So
if you have to haul it over a certain amount, then diminishing return.
Diminishing return on the haul, and it's a slow haul coming out of there. On top of that, you have trees that exceed most of the local mill's capacity to be able to break it down because it's too large in diameter,
mm-hmm.
and you end up. I know right now the foresters that are working down there are trying to market it all the way up into the middle Oregon, up into Eugene, and as far south as they can go in California to any mill that will accept it. But there's still only a certain diet of burned timber that a mill will take.
Well, and Oregon has their own.
They do.
They just went through a big bad.
Yeah. And regionally, both in Oregon and California, with the number of fires we've had that have destroyed timber, it's going to be the first person who gets it to the mill that's actually going to be able to be repaid for that work. The others are just going to be rejected. And, you've seen other places in Southern California, the Big Bear area, the places in the Sierra, where they couldn't market the timber. It ended up going out into the desert into those big incinerator machines.
Wow.
What a total waste.
Yeah.
So our environmental policy that requires us to not harvest timber or makes that, it's emotionally not okay to harvest timber. How's that? Because it's better for the land, better for the forests, all that.
If you burn it?
So now we're burning it. And even if you burn it, you still can't convert that to be useful for the public. And even the private land, too. I mean, it's not just public land.
Well, and I don't think it's all that healthy with all that dead burnt stand in there. That's not going to be a healthy forest.
Yeah. Well, and do you want, 25% of $50 a thousand for timber under a salvage, or do you want 25% of $600 a thousand? There's a difference between green and dead.
Right.
Right. And same, too, you can't even, I'm channeling the cogen people. So, okay, what about that?
Well, the cogen is difficult too because there's only so many burned chips that they can accept into their plant. It gums up everything. It gums up the machinery. It gums up their air scrubbers and everything else that they have to be able to meet the Clean Air Act with their
exhaust. Yeah, we talked about that last week. How they have to regulate the emissions out of those stacks, mm-hmm. and you feed garbage in, and you've got to clean all that up before it can go out. So.
Yeah, and the one cogen plant in Siskiyou County, the one at Roseburg, is throttled down to a few megawatts that basically supports their operation. the bulk of the chips in Siskiyou County either don't go anywhere or they go to Klamath Falls.
Right.
Really?
Out of the state. Yeah.
And that's not a real profitable product at that point because of the trucking costs.
No.
To haul chips that far.
No. A lot of chips that go into Oregon are subsidized at 15 cents a ton.
Oh, wow.
To truck them up there.
Wow. Someone had called a little bit earlier and wanted to know why they got rid of the mills in the first place.
Well, it was a matter of the Northwest Forest Plan, basically, shut down just about everything. And, you know, for what it was, for the protection of the owl and everything else, what it proved to be is more of a consolidation toward large, very large timber companies that could survive and took out the small guy, which was all the mom and pops operations that actually provided some competition in the market. And, you know, the big guys are going to survive one way or another anyway. And unfortunately, we've been living off of Canadian timber for far too long and burning up our own here locally.
So if you can't make a, you know, a living running a mill, mm-hmm. you close it.
Exactly.
I mean, the closure of the mills was a natural progression. It's kind of like no different than when Walmart rolls into town. You know, a lot of your
some arguments will say, well, that's because they cut their way, you know, out of existence. No. There's actually more standing trees today than there was in the 80s. But it had to do with whether or not it was available for market.
Well, the other thing, too, if they cut their way out of existence in the 80s, I don't know how many people have a tree in their front yard. But, I mean, it takes a lot longer than that to grow trees. So if they actually cut everything down, how could all this be burning up?
Yeah.
I mean, that just doesn't pencil.
And wasn't there a pretty good export market? I mean, were we shipping wood overseas at that time?
Well, you do off private land. On federal timber sales, it's a little more complicated. It has to be machined before it can be shipped. So they have to saw the log into cants, basically square it up before they can send that log overseas. And actually, the fire salvage off the Klamath in 2015 ended up going over to Brookings, the bulk of it, and saw it into cants, and it was exports because the local mills couldn't handle it. It was just way too much.
Too much.
Yeah.
I'm constantly, I guess, surprised that the forest policy is still such a mystery. You know? I mean, it.
What kind of mystery?
But I mean, to just the public in general, it's kind of a mystery.
Oh, the public doesn't understand how it works and where it goes.
Especially in the rest of the country.
Sure.
I mean, people who live here get it. I mean, the folks up in your area, a lot of areas actually in the West who live by forested land can't get homeowners insurance.
Right.
Because of all the fire danger.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and, you know, it's really not rocket science, but it is science.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I did a study in Sugar Creek outside Scott Valley with UC Merced and UC Berkeley little while ago, about 10 years ago, and we took a look at the forest in 1930, before there was any commercial activity in the forest there, and we found that we're at four times the density today of number of trees per acre than we were back in 1930, and the species composition has radically changed to more fire-prone species.
And is that from just lack of management, lack of cutting, and... And
well, this is a long. I'll try and keep it short. So, in the what was both private lands and federal lands trying to do in the 60s, 70s, and 80s? They were actually trying to get most of the old growth through the mill because they wanted to retool. Wasn't any more nefarious than that,
right?
Processing big trees is different than processing small trees.
That's right. So we had to retool, you know, the industry. Well, about the same time. Everything was shut down toward the end of that, and what that left was a much younger stand number of stems per acre across all of the land that has to be managed more intensively now and thinned but it was just left in a predisposed fire condition because we stopped managing the land.
So we prepped it.
Yeah, we prepped it
for a fire.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's how policy works at the national level.
which makes it sound like we're making that up.
It's like the knee jerk is always 20 years behind, you know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And then there's all that good Clinton policy that we should probably let you hit the high points of, because that was obviously not awesome. Take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about what happened in the 80s and how the Clinton environmental policy contributed to this, I guess, and a whole bunch of other stuff. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Do your dirty work, oh yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more. I'm a fool to do your dirty work, oh yeah.
Hey guys, I'm Bob the Drop. Welcome to my podcast. Do you like water? If you do, you're going to love me. I'm pure and simple. I'm talking refreshing. Yeah. Spent 500 years in a glacier. The boy was that cold. I never was and never will be tap water. Nope. Bottled at the source, the base of Mount Shasta. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. You can try me by calling 1-800-922-6227. Mount Shasta Spring Water.
These are unprecedented times. Challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency child care, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And we co-host Writing Roots.
It's a 10-minute podcast in which we, an author,
and her editor,
cover lessons we've learned about the writing process.
This podcast is for storytellers of all kinds. We discuss everything from the hero's journey to how to slog through that pesky middle section of your book. From filling out your author's toolbox to answering your questions about the craft and the industry. From magic to mayhem.
In September, we're talking to all your favorite archetypes. Everyone from law enforcement to stage performers. And in October, we're celebrating Halloween all month long by looking at different literary monsters every episode.
So whether you're an experienced storyteller or still working on that first book,
now is the time to check us out.
Writing Roots is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your podcasts. And don't forget to always
write selfishly.
This is something other. Busy monster eats dark holes in the spirit world, where wild things have to go to disappear forever.
That's actually why we brought you here, that age-old question we want an answer.
Yeah, we were going to spring it on you later, but...
Some guy named Bruce Cockburn wrote a whole song about it. We want to know. Inquiring minds. Okay, so go wherever you'd like to go. We'll just pretend we're not here. We're so distracting.
Well, I want to get back to a little bit about the current forested condition and what's driving some of these fires. You know, and I'm going to preface this with something. I'm not talking about brush fires. Brush fires.
No, we're talking about the massive.
I'm talking about forests.
Eat your whole life.
Timber.
Forest, yeah. Timber fires, because brush fires are a whole different animal with a different ecosystem and different things that drive it. So, you know, in the last segment, we were talking a little bit about the densification. The densification also coupled to a different age class. Younger age class that predominates the forest these days. And that's pretty important because the crowns of those trees are closer to the ground than your old growth timber. Also, the bark's a lot thinner, so they're not resilient to fire. The biggest thing, though, is a change in species composition that's affecting both water yield out of the forest as well as the fires themselves, because the older forests in the 1930s, typically in the North State, did have frequent fire in them until about 1930, and they were dominated by large ponderosa pine that are pretty fire resilient, and incense cedar, with a few other trees. Now, you know, I hate to talk in generalities because you can always point to something different, and I am going to talk in generalities because every change in elevation changes species composition and fire dynamics and everything else, or every change in aspect, north, south, east, or west, influences that as well. So with a look at where we are today, one of the things to remember is that density. So what do you do with your campfire when you want more heat? You throw more wood on it, right? That's kind of what we're seeing at this point in time. When
no forestry required.
Yeah, no forestry required on that one. So the other aspect of this is, you know, is temperature and drought. Drought plays a significant role in that we have seasonal drought in cycles every year. And those cycles typically will start, you know, sometime after May, and we won't see precipitation unless it's a thunderstorm. Until the fall.
Which just starts thousands of fires.
I know. Until the fall. Well, what that starts a drying process in all of the live vegetation that starts to approach a point where even live vegetation will grow. So we in the fuels, I'm going to get deep in the weeds here, but we in the fuels arena.
That's okay.
Start looking at, 10-hour fuels, 100-hour fuels, 1,000-hour fuels, and they're basically different size classes. And the hours are related to how many hours it takes of drying for them to react differently when they're burned, basically. So what we see is that typically our summers would have about 6 weeks or so of something we call at the 90th percentile or higher, which means it's within that top 10% of dryness. And we'd get a week or two of 98th percentile, which means you're pushing the envelope. That was annual, happened every year. Our fires typically were, in late August, early September, historically. But now what we're seeing is that because California is coming out of a wet period, and I go back to when people ask me about climate, I'm not a climatologist, but what I do is I'll go back and
I'll look. Stayed at a Holiday Inn Express?
Not even that. I don't like Holiday Express. But anyway. But I'll go back and look at Colorado State and UC Berkeley's paleoclimatology to take a look at long-term trends. Because as a forester, I think long-term. I don't think short-term. I'm looking at 100- to 200-year periods at least, because that's how long trees live. So, you know, I make a mistake today, 200 years from now, you're going to see it. That's a daunting task for the forester.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. Scared to
Although the accountability is fairly low.
Yeah, but, you know, scared to you-know-what out of me as a young forester coming out of school, and it should, every one of them. But so with that said, I don't know where I was going with this.
Sorry. Go back into our hole here.
But what we're seeing is a lengthening of those weeks during the summer, and it's caused by drought. You know, temperature isn't what we look at so much as a forester. I look more at the ambient air humidity and its interaction with the leaf surface, which either keeps the plant moist or dries it out. You know that from houseplants. Trees are no different. So, if you extend that dry period, you're going to get drier fuels on the landscape. And the sooner you do it, you know, the longer period that's going to be every year until it rehydrates itself. So we are seeing that rather than 6 weeks, we're seeing that now probably 8 to 12 weeks and up to 4 or 5 months at a time now here in the West. And it's largely a factor is driven, if I go back to the paleoclimatology thing, we're looking at California came out of a wet period of 100 years where we have our annual diurnal, our annual cycle of drought, but we also have 3 to 5 year droughts about every 10 years. But we're switching back to what California's typical weather pattern has been over the millennia, and that's droughts up to 100 years.
Oh.
That last up to 100 years. So our frame of reference as a human, and this is all the science of gas chromatography, all kinds of gas stuff that they do with glaciers and looking at trapped air masses. We're looking at something from a human frame of mind we have never seen. It's not that it's unusual. It's just unusual to us.
But it is a cycle.
It is a cycle. Everything's cyclic.
Right.
And my point as a forester is to manage the cycle of the vegetation, manage the vegetation for the cycle, because we don't have to succumb to it. You know, we don't have to run around with our hair on fire, the sky's falling, everything else. You know, there are things that we actively should be doing
to mitigate
the unintended consequences of an unfettered release of energy in these fires from Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm. And overstocking the timber in our forests is
probably
number one of the things we don't do.
Number one. If we want forested cover to perpetuate, we need to reduce stocking in the forests. We need to encourage the recruitment of the older trees on the landscape, and we also need to change the species composition going forward back to what it historically was.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you said, incense cedar and ponderosa pine are the ones that are more fire resilient
in our area.
And,
yeah.
And are those trees? Do they take longer to mature than what?
Not necessarily. They just grow in more open conditions.
Okay.
And they also require openings to regenerate. But they they're not slow growing until they hit their mature life cycle at about 150 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, grow quick. And one of the reasons in industry that everybody planted pine back in the 60s. Why'd they do that? Well, they did that because that was the only thing that they could plant, because it's the only thing that survived, because we didn't know how to plant back in the 60s. But they're all predisposed to fire these days because they weren't planted. But that's a whole discussion about they weren't planted in the right place and they're subject to insects mm-hmm. and disease. Now, the other species are more a fire occlusion species that comes in naturally when you take fire out of the ecosystem, which actually the Forest Service did in 1934.
Really?
Yes.
Was that long ago?
Yes.
We started suppressing fire?
Well, in 1934, the agency issued a mandate nationally to protect trees that included the cessation of all settler and Native American burning. And from that point forward, you can see a dramatic shift in the tree density on the landscape as well as the species shift.
And not that we probably have to say it, but it is worth mentioning that the more dense the tree cover is, the more water it uses.
That's true.
And the more nutrients are used, and they're spread out rather than concentrated. Yeah.
And the younger it is, the more water it uses.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, growing. They probably grow a little slower when they're real dense like that too, don't they, or no?
Well, they can, but the net effect with the number of stems per acre would be the same as if they were, you know, spaced out a little more than mm-hmm. they currently are.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just remember, it was a few years ago, and you had told me that when all the trees were so close together and it was so densely packed and we didn't have meadows, we didn't have open space, mm-hmm. that in areas where it snows, the snow can never get to the ground. Therefore, we have no snowpack, no late runoff.
Right.
And again, we affect our water picture.
Hey,
and that's
that,
something I think people really don't think about.
Well, and couple that with, I'm old enough as a forester to remember my younger days when there were actually wild stands that had never been entered. And one of the things I was tasked with doing here in the North State was doing the forest inventory work in those stands. And I can tell you how dramatically different they are today versus then. I mean, what we're also missing is the openness between stands mm-hmm. of timber. You know, our forests were once about 20% open, which meant there was an amoeba of opening all around in the forest that actually moderates fire behavior as well, naturally.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about that open...
That's been lost.
...open space thing, because that, of course, allows, I think, a little discussion on clear-cutting and what that does and doesn't do. And, people think you can just, if you have some timber, you can just run out there and clear-cut it all. It's like, No, that's not actually how that works. No. There are a lot of rules about that.
Oh, so I can't go buy like 100 acres of timberland and go out and cut all the trees down.
We gotta go. It's the news.
Maybe.
We'll be back. We'll be back with Ray for the next hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online. WeThePeopleRadio.us.
The same old day, but there's nothing wrong with a hard hat and a hammer. Kind of glue that sticks this world together. And the steel and cradle of the promised land. God bless the working man.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. Republican-led Senate voting to advance Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett toward final confirmation despite objections from the Democrats. Barrett's confirmation tomorrow is hardly in doubt. Promising news on the economic front. Fiat Chrysler has hired some 4,000 Detroit residents, most to be employed at a new plant on the city's east side.
The auto giant is obliged to employ at least 3,850 Detroit residents at the Mack Assembly plant under a deal with the city to develop the land where the plant is being built. If the remaining 250 workers are not employed at Mack, they could be sent to work at another Fiat Chrysler plant in Detroit or the suburbs. Under the $108 million land development deal between Fiat Chrysler and the city, the automaker said it would give Detroit residents first crack at applying for good-paying jobs at its new plant.
Correspondent Jeremy House, the mayor says pay would start at $17 an hour, could climb to $28. Also at townhall.com, a judge in Virginia has sentenced a woman to 11 years in prison for pretending to be a psychologist.
The prison sentence handed down to the 44-year-old was well above the recommended term under state guidelines, which called for a maximum of 2 years and 3 months. The woman was accused of prescribing medication for non-existent conditions and failing to properly diagnose conditions that patients did have. She also testified in court while posing as a medical expert. Ron DeRockster reporting.
Also at townhall.com, the coronavirus reaching the heart of the White House once again, less than right at a week before Election Day. Vice President Mike Pence, Chief of Staff Mark Short, has tested positive. White House says, though, the Vice President will remain on the campaign trail. He has tested negative. More on these stories at townhall.com.
I'm United States Surgeon General Jerome Adams, America's doctor. And all across our nation, we've taken steps together to slow the spread of coronavirus. Now we must continue to take personal responsibility to protect ourselves and our loved ones. Because even though not all of us risk a severe case of coronavirus, we all risk getting it and spreading it to others, maybe without even realizing that we're sick. So if we want to get back to school, back to work, back to worship, and back to overall health, there are things our country needs to do. We need to follow state and local guidelines, take extra precautions if at higher risk, wash our hands frequently, stay 6 feet from others when we can, and when we can't stay 6 feet from others, please, I'm begging you, wear a face covering. These small actions will make a big difference. So I'm asking you to say it with me, America. Coronavirus stops with me. You can learn more at coronavirus.gov.
Produced by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services at taxpayer expense.
Israel's cabinet says yes to normalizing relations with the UAE.
Israel's cabinet has officially ratified the Treaty on Normalization with the United Arab Emirates. It also sent a normalization deal with Bahrain for parliamentary approval. Only Israel's primarily Arab parties voted against the deal with the UAE, saying it ignores the Palestinians. They are expected to do the same for Bahrain. On Friday, word came that Sudan was ready to normalize ties with Israel, coming as part of a deal for its removal from Washington's list of countries supporting terror. Yet analysts say that, unlike the monarchies of the Gulf, Sudan's military and civilian leaders, already at odds over a lot of things, might find it harder to follow through on Israel. I'm Lawrence Rifkin, Town Hall News, Jerusalem.
News and analysis at themedialine.org and townhall.com.
Voters in Maryland can begin to cast ballots in person next week. More on that story from John Scott.
Early voting centers open Monday morning and will operate daily until November 2nd. Maryland has allowed early in-person voting since 2010, but it wasn't offered during the June primary due to the COVID-19 pandemic. More than 1.6 million Maryland residents already requested mail-in ballots by a deadline earlier this month. Maryland ballots will include the presidential race, congressional seats, and two statewide questions on amending the state constitution. John Scott reporting.
Meanwhile, more than 6 million votes already cast in Texas. That's more than anywhere in the U.S. President Trump won Texas by 9 percentage points in 2016 and has shown little worry now as he spends more time and money on the clear battleground states. More on these stories at townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker.
The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. Just in time, too, because Bill was giving us a whole list of more stuff he wanted to talk about this hour. And, you know, frankly...
Well, my brain's on fire right now, not just the trees, okay?
we got a full dance card going on here. So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. If you need a tractor, implements, mowers, you name it, they have it up there. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or get them on the web at papemachinery.com. And don't forget to get your generator this week because it doesn't look like there's any rain in the forecast. So.
Well, we talked to somebody yesterday who said the power was going to be out for like 3 days or something.
Yeah, today. Wow. They were shutting it down today. So.
Yeah.
Sure,
today's October 25th, 2020. So if this is replayed at a different time, don't panic. Check your calendar. Not October 25th, 2020. Your power's not getting shut off. Just be clear.
Your turkey is safe.
I learned it the hard way. We made some derogatory remark about the president, but it was during the Obama administration when we did the show, but we aired it during the Trump administration. Then people were all mad at us because...
Oops.
Yeah, we were being mean to the president. It's like, no, not that president, the other president. Anyway, so now we have to clarify.
So... Where are we going here?
Well, on the list is open space, clear cuts, and fire behavior.
Okay.
You can do that in any order you like. And then we'll allow Bill to talk again, maybe.
Well, let's do fire behavior first.
Okay, because it kind of does all that. Sure.
Yeah, fire behavior is an interesting topic. One of the things that some of the work that I did that I'm pretty darn proud of is I had a team of experts that did modeled fire behavior. Can't be done everywhere because it took 2 years of prep work to actually get the data layers accurate enough to be able to do this work. And one of the things I was interested in doing back then, and this was, I'm getting old. It was like 12 years ago. I wanted to do some.
Are we all getting old?
I wanted to do some fire behavior modeling on the things that I couldn't change.
That was Bill, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah, Bill had a spaz attack. His brain was on fire, and he had a spaz attack.
I see that.
We might have to talk about fire behavior right here. Yeah, right. Bill's flaming out.
So, you know, there are some things we can't change. You know, you can't change topography. You know, you can't change weather trends. You can't change aspect, slope, elevation, and... what you might be able to model as far as wind directions and those kind of things. So what I was interested in doing, and having limited funds to do anything in the forest and limited ability, I wanted to know exactly where I could put fuel treatments to modify large fire behavior, because I wasn't so interested in being able to, you know, put out the small fire because 98% of them are caught. It was the 2% that got away and started rolling across the landscape that fire behavior needed to be modified. So we started that way and then actually strategically located exactly on the landscape where we had to put fuels breaks or other types of fuels treatments to modify that behavior. So that's kind of a unique way of looking at things. It kind of changed the paradigm of modern ways of looking at things on the landscape.
Well, because when the trees are all one height and there's no breaks,
it doesn't work very well. So there's two kinds of fire behavior in our neck of the woods, you know, so to speak. There's the western side of the Klamath that's largely, fire behavior is largely driven by slope and also by, you know, the drying and the density. Now, on the east side of the forest where there's not a lot of litter on the ground because it's a pretty dry forest, that's largely driven by wind and also by crown density. And what you'll see is different fire patterns. On the west side, you'll see these big amoebas that are everywhere. On the east side, you'll see long streaks across the landscape because once the wind stops, they go out. So we talk about the breaks in the canopy. One of the things that breaks in the canopy from the old 20% open did for us was it allowed a fire to drop to the ground. So either it contained itself that way or it actually moderated the severity of how it rolled across the landscape. When you got one continuous canopy, as we do today, you know, we did a lot of work in the 90s, early 2000s with eliminating fuel on the ground. We didn't do a whole lot because what we did is we rearranged that fuel and just put it up in the canopy. The canopies are still dense, and maybe on the ground it's missing, but once it gets rolling in the canopy, it won't drop to the ground, and it keeps cranking across the landscape. That produces high-severity fire that's pretty lethal to forests because once you get in the canopy, there's no recovery from that.
And then you add a whole lot of wind to it.
Yeah, and that exacerbates
millions of acres go away.
And we go back one other thing that's never talked about that I'm aware of is that there's some research out there that talks about the effects of ozone on tree drying.
Oh, yeah, you told me about that a few weeks ago. That was interesting.
Yeah, Dr. Grunke, who works out of the Arcata Research Lab for the Pacific Southwest Station, has done some work with ozone exposure and this might get deep in the weeds for some listeners, but basically stoma are the pores that are in the leaf surface that allow the exchange of air for photosynthesis. And with that, when they're open, the moisture comes out of that pore just like you would sweat. And what they found is that a one-hour exposure to ozone causes a stoma to stay open for 24 hours rather than have the diurnal cycle of open-closed. And that desiccates all the vegetation quicker. It basically puts it in a kiln dried kind of situation. So you have that occur at higher elevations a lot, where the jet stream might dip down, and you also have that anywhere where you're downwind of a large metropolitan area because of the pollutants in the air itself.
Hmm. Interesting.
Just thought I'd add that.
And we wrecked it. We ruined the show. Whoopsie. This is Gilligan's Island. We've run aground.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So when you talk about it, like Robert asked during the break when we were sitting in here, he was asking you, like, how big do the breaks have to be? How does that measurement go?
Yeah, and I gave him a pretty simple answer. That's not true everywhere, actually, because I didn't get to explain.
Oh, he lied to you, Robert.
The other half.
So
no, I didn't lie to him. No, typically 1.5 to 2 times the height of the tallest trees. And so tallest trees, you know, depending where you are, east side you're talking about a 100-foot tall tree. West side you're talking 150. But they have to be located in an area that actually facilitates that as well, like ridgetops, other places where you would naturally see the fire change its behavior. And unfortunately, what the suppression effect is on the higher elevations is it's perpetuated. And I've seen this in the amount of airtime I've spent over wilderness areas in the North State is that historically, there were open pine stands on those ridges. Now they're chock full of true fir, which is a fire a species that comes in and intrudes where there isn't fire. And so you have a continuous canopy across the landscape over those ridges. That's critically important because that has circumvented the way nature moderated fires on its own because all the lightning activity is typically on the upper third of the slope. So we had frequent fire naturally across those ridgetops that kept the density down historically and actually moderated fire behavior from one watershed to another.
Mm. So as it burned up to the top, it had the potential to just stop.
Yeah.
Huh. When we've allowed this to go, now we're having all these massive fires. Mm-hmm. We'll take a quick break, but when we come back, would you talk about what's the benefit of doing nothing? What's the danger of doing nothing? And if we just replant everything, do we just keep? I mean, I'm assuming we just perpetuate the same old bad decisions. But what happens with all these millions of acres? Because obviously it's not all going to be the woods, not all going to be removed and retreated. Do these fire breaks come back by themselves? Because my guess is it all just grows up like weeds. Like if you mow your grass, it just comes back. Okay. Well, there you go.
There you go. Spoiler
alert.
Yeah.
It all comes back. So we're going to take a really quick break. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
If we had some global warming,
if we had some global warming,
it wouldn't be 20 below,
it wouldn't be 20 below.
If we had some global warming,
if we had some global warming,
I wouldn't be shoveling snow,
I wouldn't be shoveling that blasted snow.
If we had some global warming,
if we had some global warming, I wouldn't.
KCNR Shasta is also broadcasting at K243CT Reading.
Dr. Farrell in Palisadro is now making dental work more affordable by offering a Dental Discount Savings Plan annual membership. The Dental Discount Savings Plan is simple, straightforward, and includes 20% off all treatment, such as emergency limited exams, restorative work, fillings, crowns, partials, bridges, dentures, and periodontal treatment, a comprehensive exam, oral cancer screening, a TMJ exam, a periodic exam, and two sets of x-rays, along with cleaning and two fluoride treatments. The program is a discount plan, not a dental insurance plan, and is only available at the office of Dr. Farrell. The Dental Discount Savings Plan annual membership provides immediate eligibility. No yearly maximum, no deductibles, no claims to submit, no limitations for pre-existing treatment, and no waiting periods. Children on the plan must be 15 years or younger. Some restrictions apply. Membership prices may vary. Contact Dr. Farrell, located at 9461 Deschutes Road, Suite 2 in Palisadro. Call 547-57 to make an appointment today. That's 547-5757.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
And we co-host Writing Room.
It's a 10-minute podcast in which we, an author,
and her editor,
cover lessons we've learned about the writing process.
Writing Roots is available on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your podcasts. And don't forget to always
write selfishly.
I'll do my best. I'll do my best to do the best I can. Yeah, I'll do my best. I'll do my best to do the best I can. To keep my feet from jumping from the ground and fear. To keep my heart from jumping through my mouth and fear. To keep the path.
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, so after all these fires have burned down millions of acres, obviously we don't have enough people to go running out there to, you know, there's nowhere to take most of the wood.
Mm-hmm.
So now what happens? Now that we've burned it all down. No, we saved it all because we didn't want to cut anything because that was bad. Now it's burned up for miles and miles and miles. What does that look like going forward? Well, sorry, I should have brought some Maalocs.
Yeah, I know, it's pretty ugly. Actually, the prevailing thought is it's natural and it'll recover. I guess the question is, how natural is it and how long before it recovers? So to me, that predisposes what you might have in your toolkit and what you want to do with a piece of ground. So regarding the first thing about is it natural, I would argue it's not. The fire we're seeing is not, and it's not even cyclic.
Right.
Part of it's man-made, you know, policy-made, if you will, or lack of understanding, trying to manage a living organism through politics rather than through science that drives natural processes. So something in ecology we use is something called the natural range of variability, which basically means if you do something, is this within the bounds historically of what might have happened naturally?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I would argue no on the bulk of these fires. Now, some, here we get into the anomalies again, some species actually thrive on complete catastrophic fire. Lodgepole pine, true fir. You know, they all die at once and grow at once, basically. But their silviculture is much different than the rest of the forest. Now, so once you step away from what is natural, and by natural, we tend to think of things in ecology as if you do something on the land and it recovers within 20 years, that's within what historic effect Mother Nature might have. But if it takes a millennia, then you as man have done something wrong, or Mother Nature has put it into something that it hasn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
The research, getting at what will happen next, number one, it's open land now that's easily a vector for noxious weeds that would invade the site. And because most noxious weeds are pioneer species that come in after a large disturbance like that and upset
species.
The natural ecosystem and the plants that are in it. The other thing, that if you look at the research that was done by Dr. Skinner out of the Redding Research Lab back in 2008 through 10, I believe, was when his papers were published. What you'll see is when you have a high severity fire like this on a very large area, what you've done is you've changed the microclimate for that given watershed, and you've reverted it to a more fire prone and a much higher dominated fire frequency on that particular site, so that it takes a very, very, very long time for it to recover because of these repeated fires now that will perpetuate the brush component rather than a tree right. component.
Hmm. I remember years ago I read an article about Mount St. Helens and what that ecology looks like today, and they took photographs of the area that was not reforested, that was public land. They left it all natural
mm-hmm.
to let nature reclaim it.
Mm-hmm.
Right next to it was a very large swath of Weyerhaeuser land. They went in, cleared off the dead wood, reforested, and today you have these huge stands of trees on the Weyerhaeuser land, and on the natural site, it's what you said. It's more invasive species, very few trees. Now that was a catastrophic event, like
sure.
you said. So it's probably not a fair analogy, but letting nature take its course obviously is going to take a lot longer than if you went in and reforested or replanted
yeah.
a fire area.
Well, let me give you an indication of how different these fires are in their effect, you know, because some people would say, well, they're natural.
Yeah, right.
Well,
you hear that a lot,
yeah,
which is the argument for don't do anything.
I know, and I hear it all the time. So in the scientific literature, you'll find that for the Klamath National Forest, and the Klamath Mountains themselves have been studied a great deal by researchers, and for a lot of reasons. But you'll find that the bulk of the fires are about 20% high severity, which, lo and behold, matches the 20% open, you know, that historically was what dominated those forests. But what we're seeing now is 80 and 90% severity with some of these fires. So we're out of sync with the natural range.
And that's just because the fires are bigger and hotter. And
they're hotter. They're you know there's more fuel in them, mm-hmm. and they're we've got a. I can't stress enough the density piece because of coming out of a wet period that would have carried higher densities, now is predisposed to drying and fire because the carrying capacity has been greatly diminished because of the change in mm-hmm. the drought cycle.
Right.
So left to its own devices. Where are we in 40 years? I mean, if we don't make policy changes and we don't do things differently.
In 40 years, if we don't do anything, you're going to brush fields. It's very easily documentable in the research. And you can, a forester is trained to see that. I can go out, most places in a brush field, and I can tell you how that those seral stages begin to develop over time and what it takes to get to actually a mature forest. And it's, we can get there in a person's lifetime using mechanical means and the knowledge we have, or we can leave it to nature and suffer the consequences of repeated fire and not see that for, 6-8 generations.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess, too, the other part we haven't even discussed is the human factor with all of this fire. I mean, people die.
Sure.
It costs
smoke exposure. I read a study just from Stanford just a couple weeks ago where the prolonged smoke exposure in California is actually damaging the T cells and the T cell development in children, and it's predisposing them to cancer.
Oh,
terrific!
Nice.
Yes. But we completely need to have electric vehicles because the virtually negligible emission that comes from vehicles is
going
to kill them all.
If you're really serious about carbon, you need to manage your forests.
Yeah, because there's a lot more coming off forest fires than there are coming off cars.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. The other thing too is the cost. I mean, the Forest Service mm-hmm. budget for fighting fire versus managing timber.
Yeah, yeah. There is no management anymore left. It's all been converted over to firefighting cost, and there's mm-hmm. this thing called the 10-year rolling average that was supposedly fixed. I haven't seen that fix yet, but basically, the agency sets aside a certain amount every year, and out of the general appropriation, and when that's exceeded, guess what? They have to borrow from the exceeded appropriation out of other areas like timber management, wildlife, fisheries, and recreation mm-hmm. To fight the fire, and it's a downward spiral.
Well, and
because I would imagine in I don't know, past 10 years, they've been appropriating money from everybody to try to get this under control. And this year's probably one of the worst.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, then you look at the cost from FEMA.
Yeah.
And this is all taxpayer money. So for the people listening around the country who live in the Great Plains or they live in a place where they don't have fire, you have really high moisture and, fire is something you do in your fireplace. You're paying for it.
Yeah.
We're paying for it.
You've got hurricanes in the east.
Yeah.
You got flooding, and then you got fires in the west, all of which are going to be supplied FEMA money, which all comes out of the tax base, and it just seems to go higher and higher and higher every year.
Well, not only that, you take, the cost is one thing, from the tax base, but look at the travesty and the tragedy in a town mm-hmm. and its ability to try and recover. From the Klamathon fire in Hornbrook just 3 years ago, we're still struggling to try and rebuild the water system there mm-hmm. because you have 60 hookups, and a $2 million price tag, to replace their water system.
For 60.
The town can't recover from
no.
that.
Well, look at Paradise. I mean,
right.
Another
burn the whole
example.
Town down.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, the fires and the smoke in our county is destroying our recreation industry mm-hmm. up there.
Yeah, see, and that was the thing. That was part of the pitch.
It was our savior.
Yeah, yeah. We're gonna get rid of all this industry. We're going to close down all these nasty mills and stop cutting all these trees because it's bad. And they're going to replace it all with the magic of recreation.
Yeah, and the critics of what I just said will say, well, look at this. All the motels are filled and everything else. Yeah, they're filled with firefighters.
With firefighters, exactly.
Or people on FEMA vouchers what do you call it, Red Cross vouchers, right. Because their homes have burned down.
Yeah, Happy Camp alone, you know, we had a population of 750 people, and 525 of them are housed elsewhere right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were in Oregon one time.
It's a fairly high percentage.
Yes.
I thought we'd go up there and grab a hotel. I think we were buying a car or something. And all of a sudden, there was no hotels. And it's like all these firefighters were in all the hotels. So we started moving down the valley. And we finally had somebody call. They said, well, the closest open hotel between Oregon and Redding is Willows.
So we just went home.
We just drove home that night. There just was no place to stay. And that's what happens.
But that's not your recreation industry. No, camping and hiking and
spending money on other businesses. And,
yep. Right.
You know, and, yeah.
Yeah, they can't afford it. I guess we have to take a break. Travis is giving me the watch bumping sign. I guess that's universal. You've gone over. Oh my gosh, I did. That's like 5 seconds over. Color me shocked. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Did you know that every day in the state of California, 10,000 people turn 65 years old? Yep, 10,000 every day. And the resources needed to allow you or your senior parents to be happy and healthy during these special years can be complicated at best. So where do you begin to find the local resources you may need? ReddingSeniorSource.com. This is an online senior resource directory which will connect you with everything from Medicare supplemental insurance assistance, senior transportation, estate planning attorneys, home care agencies, assisted living communities, and hundreds more. This directory has been a labor of love created by me, Mary Ann Seifert, owner of Mary Ann Senior Placement Services. I have over 2 decades of experience assisting seniors in our community and saw a need for resources to be accessible by everyone. Just go to ReddingSeniorSource.com. That's ReddingSeniorSource.com.
Hi, my name is Owen Gavigan with Shasta Window Cleaning and Shasta Tubworks. My phone number is 275-2762. I clean commercial and home windows, and I repair bathtubs and showers. I have a state contractor's license for my tub business, and I have operated both businesses for over 20 years. All work is performed by me. My phone number is 275-2762, and I'm also online at Shasta Tubworks. Thank you much.
Hi, I'm Arielle Winter. If you're anything like me, your pets are not only your best friends, they're part of your family. American Humane, which has been rescuing animals like Cleo here for more than 100 years, has life-saving tips that can make a big difference before, during, and after disasters such as hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, or wildfires. So when disaster strikes, you want to be prepared to protect them. Be sure to microchip or tag your pets. Never leave them behind in a major crisis, and be sure to have an emergency kit ready in your home at all times with a pet crate or carrier, leash, blanket, ID, and medications, their water bowl, and 7 to 10 days worth of food. To find out how to protect your entire family during a disaster and help our best friends in their worst times, please visit AmericanHumane.org.
Smoke.
obviously they've never lived where there was an actual fire.
It's not that distant.
Because it's not that distant and it's not a mist.
No.
Your eyes are red all summer. So yeah. We were, again, talking on the break unceremoniously when no one could hear us about the idea that you had said that it damages the T-cells in children with all this mm-hmm. smoke that they're breathing in. So, of mm-hmm. course, I'm hearing people who don't live in rural areas saying, yeah, but they burn wood in their fireplaces, yeah. and they're running wood stoves, and that's doing it too.
Yeah. Well, if you look at that study, it delves into that quite a bit, and it talks about the difference of wildfire smoke from these forests versus prescribed fire and other fire sources. And the difference is the temperature at which a large fire burns. And
that's in the dead of summer when it's 100 degrees plus.
And the duration is very long, which volatilizes gases that aren't volatilized on during other burning type mm-hmm. activities. So it's,
it just burns everything.
Everything. And, we're talking a little bit about the effect. And, when you end up with these fires burning, all of the organic material out of the soil. One of the things that's interesting about forested soils versus agricultural soils, everybody thinks, well, you just go out and fertilize it. No, you don't do that. What happens to get to a mature forest is, forest soils are pretty thin in general, less than 12 inches, most of them. Most of them 2 to 3 to 4 inches deep. And they don't have an A horizon, which means you're not cycling very much organic material into that. But you have to, what they do is they do something called bioaccumulation, which means you may start off with brush and it accumulates nutrients. The brush collapses, it gives it up to the next stage, which might be some seedlings of a shade tolerant species. And then they give theirs up to the next generation of ponderosa pine or something like that. So you're accumulating in the vegetation itself, not in the soil like you might mm-hmm. have in an ag soil. So when you rip a fire through and it burns all the way down into the soil, you're starting from basically what was a volcanic eruption type soil or beach sand and trying to rebuild an entire ecosystem right. again on that same place. Yeah. That's why these fires are so harmful
much sterilized, literally.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. So you end up breaking up even the composition of that soil from a standpoint it's easily transportable mm-hmm. As soon as it starts to rain, and it doesn't have any nutrient value left in
right.
it.
That makes a lot of sense, because when you look at the hills around here from the all the big fire we had a couple of years ago, those hillsides are still dirt. There's really nothing there yet.
Yeah, they're pretty sterile.
So that tells you how hot that fire was that ripped through.
Yeah.
So.
It also,
and for all the people who really like the, are really animal lovers.
Yeah, well, and the other thing it does, too, is, it takes quite a while to break down what's now a hydrophobic situation where the soil won't wet itself, because what's released with trees when they burn are the waxes and things that are in the leaves themselves. They get clogged in the soil pores, and they surround all the soil particles so that they don't absorb water.
They just get runoff.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh. I did not know that. I didn't know soil.
You should have taken my class.
I didn't know soil had pores.
Yeah.
I'm deficient at the real basic level. No idea soil had pores.
Which
about metasediments again.
Yeah.
Explains why when they go along and they burn the roadside grasses and whatnot, the next year the nice green grass comes back and it all looks real nice, because you're not dealing with that scorched earth heat that you get in a forest fire.
Can I switch to...
Do it. Something random?
No, nothing random.
You're not a random guy.
But why I keep talking about mechanical means of manipulation in the forest, and it comes down to a very basic understanding of the magnitude of the issue at hand. So I did some simple math, for the forest I live on, which is the Klamath. And I take there's a natural fire return interval of about 20 years, 15 to 20 years, depending where you are. That's an average. And so what you have to do to mimic nature is you have to repeat that somehow every 20 years on the acres there. So if you take the total acres and divide it by 20, that should give you an indication of how many acres have to be affected just to keep up with the growth.
Mm.
And not only tree growth, but the brush growth and everything else.
Everything else, yeah.
So on the Klamath, for instance, their total vegetation program, I think, is somewhere around 50,000 acres. Just to keep up with the growth, it should be 250,000.
I was going
to
say that's not okay. enough.
And if you think we're going to burn 250,000 acres in a prescribed fire every year,
no.
The regulation, the law alone will not allow it. And neither will the public, accept that kind of disturbance. So you have to use all the tools to get at that 250 acres. And as a reference, you know, I was telling somebody else this too, on the Klamath in the heyday of the 80s that everybody seems to think everybody wants to return to, the Klamath grows somewhere around 600 million board feet a year, and that's just in merchantable saw timber. That's not all the biomass and everything else. That's just merchantable saw timber. During its heyday, it cut about 120
wow.
a year, 150 at the highest, I think. So it didn't even come close to cutting the growth, though it was a horrible era.
Yeah,
according
it was,
to most.
We were decimating the forest at that point.
So, I mean, it didn't even come close to harvesting unsustainably. Based on forestry terms, not whatever the new age sustainability definition is.
Right.
And the little prescribed fires that they're talking about, we're going to do some of that, and that's going to bring fire back in the landscape, and that's going to solve our problem.
No. Burn windows are short. They're encumbered by limited operating periods for owls and for fish, and you have to have clean air shed clearance, you know, under the... And when all those things line up perfectly, then you can go out and do your prescribed fire.
Yeah, 200 acres.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, those prescribed fires for the immediate area, they might do good as far as fire control for the next year. But in the big picture, they do no good at all.
Yeah, no. Now, I use them a lot, okay? But I use them in conjunction with mechanical work. So when you do the thinning, and that kind of thing, you know, just walk away. You know, your fuels treatment is prescribed fire or pile and burn or some other method like that, which is actually beneficial. A prescribed fire at that intensity actually recycles some of those nutrients we're talking about back into the trees that are still on site. So you're artificially fertilizing them, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's something a lot of people don't understand, too, is when you see the log trucks going down the road, they're not out there stripping the forest. I mean, they are doing what they call selective cutting, and they're leaving trees at a certain distance, and that's exactly what you want.
And there's a lot of rules.
For the most part,
It takes a long time to be able to do that.
Yeah, there are clear cuts. You know, industry practices
And so the benefit of that, or the reason you would do that?
There are silvicultural benefits, because some tree species will not do well in uneven-aged management like you were just selective cutting, like you were just talking about. They need full open sunlight. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to manage a stand that has Douglas fir in it and ponderous pine, and you keep doing selective cutting of the tallest trees in there, which is typically what was done in the past, you end up with true fir in the end. You can see it with
the... Is it not enough sunlight?
Not enough sunlight reaching the forest floor.
Right.
And the only recruitment, new trees that will come into that stand are the ones that are shade tolerant, that'll generate under shady conditions. So places for clear cutting, I honestly don't like it much in California because of the drought cycles, you know, because it is difficult for regeneration under full sunlight conditions. Again, tempered with aspect and elevation and all those other localized conditions that do make it successful. And with tree species. You know, some tree species, again,
well, like
better.
Redwoods. You can't really select cut redwood.
No. And the other thing is once you get over a certain volume per acre and you start dropping trees, selectively, like, you know, every tree that falls opens a hole, if you will. Mature ponderous pine its crown can occupy a full quarter acre. When it comes down, guess what?
Yeah.
you've got a quarter acre opening. So at some point, depending on the, you know, the health of the stand, if the bulk of it needs to be extracted, even if you select cut it, you're going to have a clear cut when you're done.
Sure. Yeah. You drop a big tree like that, and well, plus it's going to take other trees out, and just yeah. you can't do it.
Now, there are other reasons, you know, for disease and insect control and those kinds of things. You know, it's just not, you know, it works much better in Oregon. Where you have clones of Doug fir and that kind of thing.
A lot of clear cutting in Oregon.
Well, that's because that's the way Doug fir works very mm-hmm. well. So California's, again, I go back to Mother Nature, California's natural range of variability is a fire dominant type thing that punched some holes in the canopy, you know, 2 to 5 acres. Okay. So clear cutting above 5 acres is a little outside the, you know, what you probably should be doing from a historic perspective. Now, you go to Oregon, the disturbance regime there, once you get north of Roseburg, is not fire historically. It's wind. Mm. And wind typically blows down 100, 200, 300, 400-acre swaths.
Right.
And
well, plus, when you thin it out,
yeah,
they can't support each other.
And so the trees that grow there are naturally adapted to regeneration that way and survival.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. The other thing, too, we were, I know we have to take a break, but we were talking about land that's really well, that most people would think is really well manicured. You know, mm-hmm. the underneath part doesn't have any of the ladder fuels or any of that.
Yeah.
But the trees are all still, let's see, they're close enough together that there's no gap in the in the top of the trees.
Yeah.
And those guys burn down, that burns down just as quickly as everything else.
Yeah, and for two reasons. It is connected canopy at that level where the fire rolls through it. But then again, what's critically important, even for prescribed fire, is that heat has to vent somewhere.
No. Yeah.
So when you have fire on the ground with no break in the canopy, it's like building a fire underneath an umbrella.
It all goes back to, like, okay. Scouting, you know.
Yeah.
Like, if you can build a campfire, you can understand forest fire because it's just happening at a much bigger level.
Yeah.
Kind of sad. Everything I learned as a kid, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
And then we, you know, rush out, get smart, and forget about it. Mm-hmm. Got to take one last quick break, and we'll be back with you. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
At Shasta Regional Medical Center, we're specialists in emergency care with the experience and training to deliver expert diagnosis and treatment to all emergency patients. Shasta Regional Medical Center is certified as an advanced primary stroke facility and is one of the nation's 50 top cardiovascular hospitals and is a fully accredited chest pain center. In an emergency, when every minute has meaning and every second counts, choose Shasta Regional Medical Center, your choice for emergency care. Shasta Regional Medical Center, caring for our community when minutes matter.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. We bring you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites.
You'll hear from experts on national security, the environment, veterans affairs, world politics, and everything in between.
Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your John Deere Ag and Turf products.
Join us every Sunday from noon until 2. wethepeopleradio.us.
Black Bear Diner is celebrating this fall with the craze you'll crave.
A craze I'll crave?
Yes. Cheesecake drizzled with pumpkin spice, praline sauce, and chopped pecans. Sip on a creamy pumpkin pie cold brew or savor pumpkin spice pancakes with maple butter for the perfect fall experience. Now for a limited time only.
Mm, I'm craving it already.
Black Bear Diner has carryout, curbside pickup, and delivery options.
Start your order at blackbeardiner.com or visit them on site for an outdoor dining experience.
Black Bear Diner.
Bye.
couldn't find one that said he blinded me with science, so, you know, sorry. You got to cut it both ways today.
Okay.
you got the song about Ray, and then you got the girl science song, so, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so we got a couple of charts on here on the website for today.
Sure.
That I guess we should let you explain, otherwise no one will know what they're there telling them.
Sure. If you take a look at that, you'll see two charts on there. One chart clipped from 1980 to, I don't have my glasses on, 2020. And what you'll see is an increase in temperature according to that. And, you know, some would tout that's a trend that we're following and further proof that we're going off the edge or going off the rails.
But the actual chart itself starts in 1900, and when you look at it, it's like it was actually hotter.
Yeah, it was actually hotter in 1910 and in 1930, and that's pretty important, too, because 1910, for you fire historians, is the year of the big burn that burned a lot of Washington State, Idaho State, and Montana.
Really?
Yeah, and was actually part of the reason the Federal Land Management Agencies came into existence was to not repeat that again.
The
1930 piece is the Dust Bowl era, if you will, and then we went into this steady decline after that all the way to about 1965. It started bouncing up a little bit, and interesting enough to me on the bigger chart is 1980 was a huge fire year. In California, the siege of 1980, and nearly half the state was on fire that year. Well, it was actually a pretty low temperature year.
I was going to say, relatively speaking.
So the correlation is kind of loose, if you will. Hmm. And I only bring this up because one thing that one of my pet peeves is people ask me about different things, and I always want to tell them science isn't that clear, and it isn't that clear on a lot of things. It doesn't matter what the subject is. You know, when somebody says to me, the science is settled, or you know, all scientists agree, that person doesn't know anything about science.
Well, or they're not actually talking to actual scientists.
Because the whole point of science is not to agree.
Right.
And to continue questions. And, you know, that's kind of the world I live in, and I'm sorry, I don't give easy answers, simple answers to things, because the world is very complex. And
yeah, there's a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, it seems like the more you know, the less you know.
Sure. But there are some things that we're doing,
that
we are doing, that have become fashionable forest policy, I guess, which is not cutting trees, that sort of thing.
Sure.
And people see any type of, well, we also stopped. And we prevented, how about that, a lot of the fuels removal underneath the power lines.
Sure.
And we did that for a long time. And, well, if your power's off today, you see how that worked out.
Yeah.
And catching back up with that and doing that fuel removal.
Yeah.
There's had to pass a bill in Congress to be able to remove fuels under power lines.
Pretty crazy.
That's insanely stupid.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of an interesting thing. You know, I did a lot of research yesterday prepping for the show, because I know one of the things you were interested in was climate change and that kind of thing.
Because I hear it all the time.
It's darn near impossible to find peer-reviewed science. There's a lot of research out there, but peer-reviewed is hard to come by. And I could only find things because I knew specifically where to look. But if you Google things, it's
all over the map.
Yeah, it's all over the map. You know, there's some climatologists I might follow because I know their name, kind of a thing. But unless you do that, it's difficult to look at. There's some things. There's so many things that affect climate: ocean currents, sunspots, solar cycles, the wobble of the Earth. Most people don't know the Earth wobbles, but it does. You know,
really?
It wobbled a great deal when the right before the Ice Age, when the meteor hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs. Well, that wobble produced a dramatic climate change. Every time the Earth changes magnetic polarity, it wobbles. More recently, one of the biggest wobbles is caused by the big dam
in China.
Built in China.
Yeah.
You know, and all of that affects our weather and our long-term climate because it changes ocean currents and everything that drive our weather.
Yeah. Well, and then also you have when you talk about temperature changes, I mean, volcanoes. I mean, there's been years where sure. volcanoes have cooled the earth for years and years.
Yeah.
Because of the
so the idea cover. That we can... because in the last few weeks we've talked a lot about our energy policy yeah. in California and how that is actually driven and how crazy it is.
Yeah.
I would encourage people to go back and listen to those shows with Jesus Arredondo because he had a lot of good information. So if we continue to go off the cliff of getting rid of all of our fossil fuels and all this stuff because we're going to stop climate change, which will then stop the forest fires, and that's how we're going to stop forest fires. We have roughly a 0% chance of doing that.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I'm not trying to stop forest fires. What I'm trying to do is make the forest more resilient to be able to survive them
yeah.
and put them in a condition where they can do that and where we can do a lot more prescribed fire and accept some natural fire in places that we can't manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because otherwise, honestly, we've put these resources into public land management so the public can enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
But how enjoyable is it to walk around on a moonscape filled with gray dust? I know you went to a meeting once after one of the fires, I forget which one, and there were some environmental people, I'll never forget, you told me that on the phone. They stood there and they looked out over the moonscape with just the black little black sticks sticking out of it. And they were like, oh, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, I'm so glad I wasn't there.
Wow.
We would have had to assault them.
Yeah.
What the heck? I mean, who looks at that and thinks that's beautiful? So natural, right? Wasn't that the thing?
Beautiful was the term. Natural, I don't see it as natural, but,
no.
you know.
No, we didn't used to burn things to a crisp
Each
and
zone.
Have nothing left.
Yeah.
So as far as what people can do, any suggestions besides just be smarter and educate their friends and family that,
well, I think
SUVs burning down the forest?
I think it's really important to understand that defensible space is real important. Okay, it's real important to clean out the stuff around your house. One of the things that firefighters often do is they're preoccupied doing that for you at the time of the fire rather than fighting the fire.
Ooh. Yeah, that's bad.
In fact, half or better than the workforce a lot of times on a fire is doing that type of prep work that you should have done on your own.
Mm-hmm.
That would help in the firefighting efficiency quite a bit. The other thing is, don't rely on that as protecting your home, because that is not going to stop these mega fires
no.
from ravaging your community.
No, because what do they say? Is it 100 feet now you're supposed to clear
yeah,
out?
Yeah, but, you know, 100 feet is nothing, when you have a...
high wind,
it, well,
fairly hot fire.
When you have a pyrocumulus cloud that's stretching up there to 25,000 feet and acting basically like a tornado...
Mm-hmm.
Whipping winds and firebrands all over the place. That 100 feet is...
Your 100 feet is like...
Well, it's dropping. It's nothing. Dropping hot embers miles ahead of yeah. the fire line. What's 100 feet going to do for you?
Nothing. It will protect you. You know, if you do defensible space, one of the things that does help with is the spot fires.
Right.
You know, for smaller spot, you're not going to stop the flaming front that rips through the neighborhood. But spot fires that start inside, and you know, the ones that take out this house, leave that one.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You do a great deal protecting your home against that.
Mm-hmm.
So, roof wise.
Yeah.
There was one in the car fire here in Redding. There's a house down there I drove through. It was, I don't know, a month after the fire, maybe. There was this one house that had a shake roof. They were, like, curled. The shakes
wow.
were so dry.
Yeah.
And that house was still there.
That's amazing.
I thought, okay, well, that makes no sense.
I wouldn't advocate that.
But, yeah, yeah.
You know, there are lots of anomalies with fires. You know, truthfully, a lot of the fires do start from an ember lodging in a window sill.
Really?
Yeah. Or actually getting in a roof vent in your eave.
Yeah, I hear a lot of that.
I've heard that.
Yeah. They go into the vents and
yeah.
you can't stop it.
Yeah.
You
can
put
you
a sprinkler on your
that?
Roof, put that
yeah.
one up.
Well,
yeah.
you can buy vents now that you can close. In fire-prone areas, and I would certainly look at building materials if you've got a house too.
Yeah, they also have fireproof paint that you can put on your house.
Yeah,
yeah,
and a hardy board product for siding, you know, is cement. basically. That's right. Pretty decent stuff, too.
Yeah, there were some folks up kind of by Pollard Flat up there, and a family at multiple homes, and the one guy had sprinklers, and everything was set up, and he said, hey, you guys want me to help you do yours? And they were like, oh, that's silly. We're not doing it.
Yeah.
This is the only house left.
Yeah, but the whole, you know, the whole focus should be to reduce the amount of energy being released at one time in these fires, because the radiant heat, I don't care what you do to your house, it'll get you. I've seen, you know, 60-inch sugar pine fully engulfed and explode because of the radiant heat that just cooked them.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a good distance away.
Sure. It just gets so hot by the time the fire gets there, it's already ready to burn.
Yeah.
Ray Haupt, thank you for hanging with
us
today.
Ray.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we will do it again. It's a fast run. You can send this show to your friends and family. Robert will put it up for us commercial-free and on video, and you can find that at wethepeopleradio.us.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional.